Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Renoites. Renoites is a weekly interview podcast where I talk to all sorts of folks from here in Northern Nevada. My name's Connor McQuibby. I'm your host, as always. Today is the last episode of the current season of Renoites. I do about 10 episodes or so in a season, and this is the last one for my kind of winter slash early spring season. I'm going to take a few weeks off and come back with new episodes in, I don't know, about a month or so. This is a fantastic episode to end the season on with Chris Wagner from the Reno News and Review. The very first episode of Renoites was with Bob Conrad from This Is Reno, and I've done a handful of other episodes along the way with folks from local media, and the Reno News and Review has had an important part in our local media ecosystem for as long as I can remember, from when it was a print alt-weekly to now being a monthly and being online in the interim during the kind of COVID years. Chris is the new editor-in-chief. She's been in that position for a little while, and was great to have her on the show to talk about the work she's doing at the Reno News and Review, as well as her other project, Double Scoop, which is a arts-oriented publication about arts events in the entire state of Nevada. Really great to be able to sit down and talk to her about her work and the art community here in the Reno area. Like many other episodes this season, this one was recorded at the National Automobile Museum. Thank you so much to the Automobile Museum for giving us a place to record this and other episodes. They have a cool little podcast studio that it's been awesome to be able to record in, and they also have a bunch of events going on. They have a cool theater there, so check out their website. It's automuseum.org and see what upcoming events they have at the theater, and just go check out the museum. It's a cool spot. Really glad to have that as a thing to do here in the Reno area. Of course, when I am between seasons, that is a great time to reach out and let me know who you would like to hear on the show or what you thought of the last season of guests. You can shoot me an email, Connor, C-O-N-O-R, at renoites.com, or send me a message on Instagram, also a good way to get a hold of me. Let me know who you'd like to hear on the show. I do have most of next season already kind of lined up, but there's always opportunity to find potential guests for the future. If not next season, then who knows, maybe the one after. So if you think of someone who would be a good fit for a guest on the show, please let me know. And of course, if you're enjoying the podcast, please help me make it financially sustainable. You can contribute to the show on Patreon. Patreon's a website that lets folks support artists, creators, podcasters, musicians, whatever, directly through a subscription model. Basically, for as little as $3 a month, that's about a dollar an episode, you can help to make Renoites a financially sustainable, financially viable kind of project. This is a very community-oriented, listener-funded show. I don't have ads and sponsors, nor do I really want them. So anything you can do to help make the show financially sustainable, it does cost some time and money to make this thing, would be greatly appreciated. You can learn more at patreon.com. That's patreon.com/Renoites. Of course, if you'd like to learn more about Double Scoop or the Reno News and Review, you can find them online too. Double Scoop's website is doublescoop.art. The best way to stay up on what's happening in the local art scene is to join their email list and be sure to follow their Instagram. That's Double Scoop Nevada. And of course, you can find the Reno News and Review at renonr.com or pick up a copy each month from hundreds of local businesses. You'll see it around. And now this week's guest on the podcast, the editor-in-chief of the Reno News and Review and editor of Double Scoop, Chris Wagner. Chris Wagner of the Reno News and Review and Double Scoop. Double threat now, among other things. Welcome to Renoites.
So glad to be here, Connor.
Yeah. So you are, let's start with Double Scoop. So you're the current editor of Reno News and Review, and I want to talk about local media in general and the history of the News and Review. But Double Scoop is kind of where I first encountered the work that you're doing in local arts journalism. So start there. Can you tell me what Double Scoop is and kind of the story of that publication?
It's a media outlet that covers visual arts all over Nevada. It started in 2018. I was in the master's program in journalism at UNR, and that was my graduate project. Mm. I've been a reporter and an arts reporter in town for a long time, and I've always really enjoyed doing that, and I always wished that there was a more concentrated art publication, just a little artier than what the News and Review or what a newspaper would do. And I've always wished that there was something statewide. Hmm. And the reason I wish that is because Kirk Robertson used to do that. He was one of the founders of the Oates Park Art Center in Fallon. He was a poet. He passed away, I think, in 2017, unfortunately. But way back in the early 2000s, he was running the statewide art newspaper called Neon. It was great. And he would actually print it on newspaper and mail it to anyone in the state who wanted it. And I thought it was a wonderful thing. It's very hard to sustain an independent newspaper.
Yeah.
And it lasted until maybe 2007 or so. And I always thought I want there to be something else that fills that space that provides some kind of statewide discussion of art. So it was always in the back of my mind. And then finally in 2018, I learned a little bit about how a person would launch and operate an independent newspaper. I'd never learned enough. No one could ever learn enough. It's not that easy.
Yeah.
But I did it. that's what Double Scoop is.
Gotcha. So you mentioned that it's statewide, and
yes,
you know, a lot of my show is about Northern Nevada, but Vegas is a much bigger city, and it's interesting that Reno and Northern Nevada feels like it's more of the arts center of the state. I don't know if that's true or not. Vegas has invested a little bit more in things like public art in recent years. Can you talk a little bit about why you think statewide is an important way of looking at art in Nevada, and then maybe some of the differences or why you focus on Northern Nevada?
To be honest, I do it because Kirk did it. And when he did it, I thought it was cool. I'm not interested in the kind of traditional North-South divide. I don't follow sports. My heart isn't in that. I guess part of me wanted to assert that the people in this state can be classified as all one community. We share a lot of cultural influences. We share a lot of resources. We share our rank at the bottom of the ladder in education. There are a lot of things we have in common with people all over the state. Also, I used to live in a very rural part of the state. I lived in Tuscarora for a couple of years outside of Elko. And that was my first entrance into Nevada. And from there, you had to consider the whole state, your community, right? There were only 10 people or something there at the time. So you just kind of cast a broader net in the way you think about what your community is.
Yeah.
And that stuck with me.
Mm-hmm. I know that like the rural communities have like a pretty big art tradition as well. I know there's the Elko has the cowboy poetry thing, which I think is happening. That's at the beginning of the year. So it's either happening now or recently or in the near future.
Right. There's a huge and really rich tradition of art in rural Nevada. I think in every tiny town and on every ranch, there's somebody singing or writing poetry or making sculpture. Yeah, the art in Nevada is not confined to Reno and Vegas by any means.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the conditions of living in a rural environment versus living in an urban environment, what are like the benefits or drawbacks as an artist?
Oh, it's hard to speak broadly, but for a lot of people who live in rural areas, it just feels like there's more time and mental space. And people work hard. People work hard on ranches. And there's just something about being out in open space that seems to give you a little more mental headspace. And that's always good for making art, I think.
Yeah. When you started Double Scoop, so Double Scoop has not been a print publication, right? It's just been online?
Correct. It's only online.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about taking that project from your, you know, a graduate project into something that continued on to today? Like, what's that look like from when you started it to what you're doing now?
It started in a form that's a little smaller and more modest than it is now, but it hasn't changed. I started it while I was in school, expecting that it would be a lasting endeavor. So it wasn't like a paper that I handed in and, you know, expected it would be over or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So what's it looked like over those years? I know you had funding for a while. I think it was a Nevada Arts Council. You had like some grant funding for a while, and then you've done some fundraising. And I'm also learning, doing an independent podcast, that that funding projects is really hard. Can you talk a little bit about that? What's the challenges of, you know, making these things sustainable?
Well, and good for you for your persistence. Renoites is doing great. Double Scoop is a nonprofit. Our funding comes about a third from grant money, about a third from voluntary memberships and contributions, donations from our readers, and about a third elbow grease from me. I don't make a sense. And so, you know, when you say, what's the secret to being sustainable? The answers are either, I don't know, or it's a long-term situation.
Yeah. I mean, I think the answer sometimes, at least for me, is it's not yet, right?
Right.
Like maybe it will be actually sustainable for the long haul. We'll see. But it doesn't pay for itself, right? At least my show doesn't do that. So Yeah, I think that the investment of personal elbow grease, kind of that like, whatever you call it, like sweat equity, if you want to look at it in business terms, is like kind of a foundation for it. And getting past that seems like a real challenge for especially things like nonprofits or things that aren't really a traditional business model, right?
Right. It depends on how you define sustainable too, right? Like I know that your podcast is difficult to keep funded and it takes a lot of work to keep the momentum going. But from a listener perspective, it comes out on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. The conversations are always interesting. So you know, what is sustainable? Double Scoop is able to continue increasing our audience, continue offering what we think is good coverage of the arts and interesting discussions, to continue contracting new people to write for us and photograph for us. We win Nevada Press Association awards every year, and I'm proud of that because we're competing with all the major media outlets in the state. We're not in some special little media category. So we're legit and we're doing well in terms of what we're producing. So you could look at that and call it sustainable. I'm not rushing to the bank to cash my giant paychecks every week. So you could say we're unsustainable. It depends how you look at it, you know?
Yeah, well, I think when you have like passion for a project, there's also kind of a fuzzy line between something that is even intended to be a financial model versus you get legitimate enjoyment out of it, right? Like I started this show mostly just on a whim as a fun thing to do. And so even though I still have some part of my brain that's focused on, you know, on growth and financing and those kind of things, it's still like enjoyable. Even if I was, you know, as I am continuing to lose time and money creating something, it feels like a lot of people have expensive hobbies and they spend money on things that they enjoy. So why wouldn't projects like this also be okay to fall into that category, right? Why does everything have to be profitable? Do you think that's something that artists of all types kind of encounter, is this pressure to be a business rather than just to create because creating is enjoyable?
Oh, there's always that pressure. But there also, you're right, there are so many people creating something like you and like me and like so many people in our community right now who are creating it because it's something they want to see exist. Mm-hmm. Right? And you'll take some compromises so you can see that thing exist. Mm-hmm. Double Scoop is, I think it's fair to say that we've become the go-to source for anyone who is trying to connect with the visual arts community or know what visual arts events are going on. And that's a source I wanted to see exist. I'm really glad we're doing it.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you started before at the Reno News and Review, you were doing arts reporting there and you've been working in arts journalism for a long time, right? Can you talk a little bit about your work in arts journalism and kind of like what interests you in that element of the arts?
I started working at News and Review in 2004. I had done a little bit of journalism work, but I couldn't call myself a working journalist until then. I assumed that I would be the arts editor for a little while, and this would be a stepping stone to some kind of career in arts administration. I wasn't planning on making this my life. And about 2 weeks in, I realized I get to play this role in the community where I get to speak to just about everyone. I get to see what's happening in Reno from perspectives of all kinds of people I wouldn't have access to otherwise. And just being able to be in that spot and be able to see things through that many people's eyes, that was so interesting to me. And I at 2 weeks in, I was like, oh man, this is no stepping stone to arts administration. I'm here. I'm staying.
What was it like working at the News and Review? So you knew you were in it and you knew you liked it. What's it like working? It was a weekly at that time, right?
Right.
So can you talk a little bit about the process of working on, you know, arts journalism for a weekly? Can you just paint a little picture of kind of the days at the News and Review back then?
I gotcha. I think it's like it's always been in journalism. You're always working way too much and feel like you're not doing anywhere near enough. And it's the pace is fast and there's always way too much to do and you quickly decide on the fly what's getting done and what isn't. And you're always managing this. I wish this was this TV right now so you could see like my hands going 50 different ways in the air trying to make a map that doesn't make sense. It's just, it's this it's made of just hundreds or thousands of moving parts all the time, and they all move at different speeds, and you're trying to orchestrate them all, and nobody could ever do it perfectly, and you do your best, and you just get the paper out every week, or now every month.
Mm-hmm. Reno's kind of like art reputation and just cultural reputation has changed a lot. Like I mentioned frequently on the show, when I was growing up here, I always thought Reno was, you know, it was boring. It was a small town. It didn't have much to offer me. And I left to go to bigger cities because I thought that was more exciting. There was more happening. So I was gone from Reno from 2001 to 2016. And during that whole period, Reno changed so much and it got this reputation as a cool city. There was so much going on. There was more art. There was more public art, especially, I think, is a big visual, like immediate indicator for people of whether a city is artistic or not is the public art. So can you talk a little bit about that? So you've seen Reno kind of go through this long period of sometimes slow and sometimes fast change in what art looks like here. Can you just talk a little bit about Reno's changes over the years and decades? Have you seen it as someone who's been reporting on it for so long?
It's changed so much. And in one sense, it's been exciting and wonderful to see that growth. And in a part of me also has some nostalgia for the back in the day. So I arrived around 2004. And the reason I would have nostalgia for a smaller art scene is simply because things were so affordable here in 2004. Rent was cheap. It was much easier to be a working artist. There was readily available, extremely affordable commercial space. So there were several small galleries that were owned by artists. And I owned part of one of them. It was called the Fireplace Gallery. It was on 2nd in Ralston. That made for a scene that had this very Reno, very DIY flavor that I think people were very proud of. And it was fun. It was easier to get things done, right? But now we have like the museums getting larger, the amazing shows there. We have so much more public art. We didn't used to have an MFA program at UNR and now we do. Hmm. So we have these people coming in from all over the world to study art here, a handful at a time, and leaving these great little influences. So it's also great that the scene is growing.
Mm-hmm. Is it easier or harder to connect with the artists in the community when it's bigger or smaller? Like you mentioned, when it was smaller, it's a little more DIY. It seems potentially easier just to get to know everyone and collaborate more. As there's more artists and more things going on, does that make it more challenging to, you know, to keep track of all of it and to engage with as much of it as you can?
I might actually be the worst person to answer that question because I have the luxury of being in a position where I can just cold call someone and say, I want to talk to you, right? Because I'm a journalist and artists tend to want publicity. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I kind of have an automatic direct line to almost everyone. And if I were an ordinary civilian trying to connect with the art world, I'm not sure what that looks like at the moment.
You do or have done a podcast as part of Double Scoop as well, right?
Right.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the podcast and how that's kind of helped you share stories about what artists are doing and kind of the format of podcasting and how it fits into Double Scoop's, you know, assortment of journalism?
Yeah, I think it started in 2019. In 2019, I was saying that I was quite open to different formats and that we could do video and audio. And the reason we do less of that now is simply it's a little harder to budget funding and time. I pay all my contributors, by the way. I don't ask them to work for free. So paying someone to make a video is like, that's a very, very labor intensive.
Yeah.
And I haven't done that very often. So anyway, in theory, I was wide open to all kinds of formats. And there was a grad student named Prince Nesta he's from Kenya. He was a grad student in journalism. And he's the one who launched the podcast, actually. He taught me everything I needed to know about recording and audio and told me to use my voice differently on a microphone. And he recorded the first season. The first episode was with Mary Lee Fulkerson, who is Bob Fulkerson's mom and also basket artist and fiber artist, who has long been beloved and has great stories. And if you're going to listen to one episode of Double Scoop Podcast, go listen to episode one. It's still my favorite. To be honest, what I most like about podcasting is practical. You go into the studio, you record an interview, then you go home and edit it, and it's over. As a print journalist, I record an interview, and that's just step one. I have a lot more work to do. Mm-hmm. Maybe I have to record five other interviews. I have to research somebody's backstory. I have to, that's just part of maybe a 20 or 30 step process. Mm-hmm. To me, with podcasting, I always felt like I was off the hook because it was just two steps.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the reason that I do it is I like the conversation part. I don't know that I would ever want to write full stories or do a lot of additional research or all of the extra work that comes with the, you know, the joy of it comes from the actual talking part. So being able to limit the work that I'm doing to mostly just the talking to people part has been pretty rewarding. You recorded K-Wink, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about K-Wink and your history with them and kind of their place in our local arts community, because they are also kind of pretty tied in with what's happening artistically here, right?
They are. K-Wink is great. And if you're not familiar, it's an independent radio station, 97.7 FM, Reno Community Radio. They're a year older than Double Scoop, which puts them, I think it's 2017. They have a little space next to Holland Project on Vesta Street. And our connection with them came when I think I might have cold called them and asked if we could do something together or record a weekly art event recommendation show. And we still do that. It's maybe a minute or two. I don't do that show anymore. Someone else does it. The wonderful thing about K-Wink is they were so welcoming and they were so interested in having a wide range of voices of people from the community. And they do, if you just listen to it while you're driving down the street, you'll catch immediately that it's programmed by people who care about what they're doing. Mm. They care about the music they're recommending to you. They care about the independent, like, news pieces they're producing or podcasts or interviews they're doing. It's just all, like, people in my community doing the thing they love to do. Mm. That's why it's such a wonderful station.
Yeah, and you mentioned it's next to the Holland Project, which makes me think about the access to arts for young people, because Holland Project is an all-ages venue, and it seems that is a benefit to have some place that is as inclusive as humanly possible. I can't think of a place in Reno that is as inclusive as something like the Holland Project. So as someone who's worked in arts for a long time and you've kind of seen the Holland Project and the work that they do, can you talk a little bit about the kind of accessibility and inclusivity of our arts community here and what you think about that?
Sure. And I think you're right. Holland Project represents that inclusivity so wonderfully. If you have just landed in Reno from somewhere else and you're just not sure where to start looking for the scene, look at Holland Project. It is primarily a youth arts organization, right? So they have all kinds of opportunities for teens and younger adults to, like, take classes, learn different mediums, learn how to curate, see all ages concerts. But their inclusivity goes way beyond that. You'll see some of our veteran artists have exhibitions, you know, maybe only at Holland Project over the course of a few years, and you won't see them somewhere else. All kinds of community events take place there, films, talks. It's just, yeah, Holland Project's calendar is like the first thing you want to cozy up to when you get to this town, I think.
Mm-hmm. As far as inclusivity in general in the arts community, again, I'm not an arts reporter, and I have to admit I am not as informed on what is happening in arts communities in general, but I know in very many different types of arts, there's often a conversation about inclusivity and whose voices we're hearing, and what's that like in the arts community in Northern Nevada? Like, do we have diverse voices? Are we hearing from people who we need to be hearing from? What's your experience been like in that front in terms of reporting on art around Nevada?
I think in the last few years, as the rest of the world has taken inclusivity extremely seriously, I've seen all of our arts institutions take it extremely seriously too. I think people are reaching out to different communities and trying to make sure they have different voices. I'm not sure how to speak about this specifically, mm-hmm. though. Like, it's hard to speak on behalf of any given institution. While I am seeing a deliberately inclusive stance from arts organizations and educational institutions, I don't think we should ignore the fact that there still are artists who move out of town because they feel like they aren't getting the audiences who are really connecting with them or listening to them. Double Scoop early on published a piece that I'm quite proud of. This writer, he's an artist. He lives in town. His name is Hostler Gomez, and he had just graduated from UNR's art department. And his article was about what's that Ariana Grande song? Like, thank you, goodbye.
Oh, thank you, next.
Thank you, next, right? His article is headlined, thank you, next. And his stance was, I am the Latino face on the UNR art department poster. I am the only Latino in the program at the moment. I am making this work that I would like audiences to read from more perspectives than it's being read to. I don't feel like I can find my audience here. I'm leaving. I'm going to New York or somewhere big. Hmm. And he didn't end up leaving town. He's still here and he's making fantastic work. It's like pretty cerebral work about like labor and work. And it's wonderful. Try to catch him. But I was happy to publish that perspective. Like he was really grappling with that. He was like, I'm not finding my audience here. And other people have told me that as well. Like that, you know, it's just too hard to be like a super vocal Black queer artist here and I'm going somewhere else. So I don't want to ignore that, right? I mean, I do want to celebrate the efforts that have gone into diversity. And I don't think I can name an institution who isn't putting in some great effort and doing some great things for diversity. But I don't want to be, I'm not the cheerleader saying we've got this.
Yeah.
Because I don't think anyone's totally got this.
Right. Yeah, I know that like artists leaving the area is a frequent topic of conversation among arts people. Like I've had people on the show who have since moved away from Reno because they can have a career somewhere else that is harder to make happen here. Is that just an economic issue? You mentioned that it's sometimes hard to find the audience. Is it that we don't have a well-developed art audience in Reno? Like maybe we have good art coming here, but are the people in Reno not going out to see it, not going to pay for it? What are some of those challenges that artists see that, you know, that don't let them maintain a life here?
I think one of the telling markers to look at is this particular collection of, and let's just talk about visual arts for a moment.
Yeah.
Of visual arts venues that we have. We have two art museums. The Lilly Museum at UNR, I think, is focusing a bit on showing local artists. The Nevada Museum of Art, you'll see local artists occasionally, but that is certainly not their main focus. Okay, so we've got those two large institutions. We have essentially one large, successful commercial gallery, that's Stromel Gallery. It's wonderful. They show a wonderful range of work, but they have a brand of work, right? Mm-hmm. And then we have a good handful of what we in the art world are called emerging galleries or emerging artist galleries, where those are a good place to start your career. You can have your first show there. They'll be very supportive of you. It's a great place to launch. And so in between those emerging artist galleries and the Stremel and museum level, there are not a lot of venues. And artists need this whole career ladder to climb to really sustain an art career. Cities our size and a little larger, I tend to have a more complete ladder. Mm. But then again, like that sort of lack of gallery infrastructure or gallery ecosystem, that's kind of made us who we are to some degree too, though. Like that's kept this particular kind of momentum going in the scene. So it's, you know, it's two sides of a coin. Like I love the scene we have, and I do wish things were easier for the artists who live here. Mm-hmm. And then there's another phenomenon related to that. There are a good number of artists who live here because they have jobs as art professors here at UNR or at TMCC, any school in the region, right? And those are artists who've been really ambitious and solidified their reputations in the national art world and have exhibitions outside of Reno and outside of the country. And you very rarely get to see their work in Reno, right? Because we don't actually have the right venue for them.
I'm trying to think if there's a follow-up on that.
I don't even know if that's like, that's just so insider baseball sometimes.
That is what this show is. Chris, I'm realizing you seem too concerned about what the audience thinks.
Right? I have to obsess about that all day as I'm writing.
I really love when guests are talking about things that they are enthusiastic about or that they care about or that they know about, whether or not an audience would give a shit about it.
I would love to indulge in the not overthinking for a minute life, yeah. But I don't know if that's accessible to me.
Yeah. Is that a part of your personality too? Because obviously you've worked in journalism for a long time. So do you think that doing so kind of gears your brain to always be thinking about audience perception and audience awareness and what people are going to think of what you're putting out in the world?
I will walk around my house and rewrite a sentence so that it has a number of syllables that's a little more comfortable to read than another version of the sentence. And my family is not helping because our family culture is all about obsessing over how can you make the joke a little funnier? How can you write the sentence a little better? We'll give each other the space to say it 25 times or 100 times. Like, that is what we do for fun.
Mm-hmm.
So it's... You know, it's both an occupational imperative and the most indulgent form of lovely everyday fun that there is. So I'm in.
Yeah. Are there parallels in that in like the visual arts world or like people who are creating other types of arts? Do you think also kind of obsessive about perfecting the thing that they're working on?
Oh, you wouldn't believe the level of obsession that goes into any professional art endeavor whatsoever. One thing that really surprises people is, Have you ever watched someone hanging an art exhibition in a gallery or a museum?
Mm-mm.
Okay, it sounds pretty straightforward, right? You just walk in there, you stick a nail in the wall, you hang a picture. Oh, no. It's you're obsessing about like sight lines and the design of the wall and the way you would read something if it's here as opposed to if it's 2 inches away from here. It's absolutely everything you see in his exhibition has been obsessed over to like a degree that I think a normal civilian could not possibly believe or tolerate. Yeah. I mean, you sit in on an art school class. The level and depth of things that people are thinking about is astounding. And yeah, to me, that's like air or food. That's the most interesting thing.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about Burning Man, because you can't talk about art in Northern Nevada without talking about the influence of Burning Man. And obviously, we see that most apparently in the public art here. A lot of the public art that we have chosen for our city is very Burning Man-esque. It is often directly from the playa. So can you talk a little bit about Burning Man? I'm assuming, been to Burning Man a number of times, and you are well aware of how Burning Man kind of connects with our community. So just talk a little bit about Burning Man and how you've seen that affect our arts world here.
Well, we just talked about Reno not having quite enough gallery infrastructure. We have, I think, more public art than a town this size normally would have. And I think that's largely due to our availability of Burning Man artwork. So long story short, a few decades ago, a few people started trying to convince the city of Reno that it should have an arts and culture commission. It should be paying attention to arts. And I'm actually not up to speed on exactly who said what to whom. But at this point, I can tell you that the city is pretty committed to making sure that we have arts in the city and arts that are very accessible to people. So having lots of sculptures outside is one way to do that. Burning Man artists tend to, this isn't universal, but the usual process is you'll design an ambitious piece of sculpture that will be on the playa for a couple of weeks, and then what did you do with it? You haven't designed like a lifespan for this sculpture. So the sculpture may end up sitting in a warehouse in Gerlach or Sparks forever. And artists try to negotiate different futures for these these pieces of art. I think the city has realized that there's access to all of these sculptures. So there are a handful of people who make it their mission to connect the city with artists and in different ways. So because of that, I think we've ended up with a lot more public sculpture than we would have otherwise.
Yeah. The space whale was in the news a couple of years ago about what to do with the space whale, because the city leased it for a period of time. And then, I don't know the details, but it didn't have a planned future beyond that. So it came down to, well, now what do we do? Is that one of the challenges of having not just the, you know, there's the very short term timeline for it on the playa, then there's a medium term as a piece of public art in one space, and then Do you see the challenge or future challenges of, well, what next for these pieces or the space whale in particular?
I actually don't recall. I've lost track of what happened with the space whale. I think the city may have purchased it outright. Hmm. I actually don't remember the exact details. But the thing to think about there is that if you've designed a piece to be at Burning Man for 2 weeks, you haven't designed that piece necessarily to remain outdoors for the next 50 or 100 years. And you haven't designed that piece to adhere to whatever engineering requirements a city might have. So there are all kinds of arrangements are made for temporary artworks. There isn't really exactly a standard roadmap for that. So if there's some quirks in that process, that's entirely understandable. I don't spend a lot of time worrying about the space whale situation. for that reason.
I mean, me either. But it seemed like for a minute, it was a very contentious conversation about what we're spending on it, who's spending on it, who owns it, who should own it, like all of the things. It seems like sometimes there are these touch points with public art or whatever that get a lot of the community engaged in talking about a thing that is related to our art. So that's the first thing that comes to mind when I think of public art, is that the space wheel is one that people talked a lot about, right? There's a lot of other public art that is nice that we appreciate, but it doesn't like hit a bunch of news stories all at once.
Potholes, damn it. It always comes back to the argument always comes back to, why isn't the city fixing potholes? Why did the city spend money on this? Why is the city not meeting our basic needs if it's spending money on artwork? I would say to that, the percentage of the city's budget that is spent on artwork is very, very small. And for a lot of reasons, one of them being the availability of Burning Man artwork, the city can do a lot with a little. And, you know, you're going to find different opinions about whether it's okay to have NASA send people to the moon before we have eradicated homelessness. There are different ways of thinking about that. I think it's okay for the city to spend a few dollars on art.
Yeah. The temporary nature of the art on the playa is an interesting aspect of Burning Man. And not just the art, but the city itself, right? The whole concept of Black Rock City is you build a city and then it goes away. And a lot of it literally gets burned down, right? So there's this kind of, you know, concept of art that is only here for now and then it is gone. And I think Burning Man really embodies that. Can you talk a little bit about that kind of creation of art with the intent of it only existing for a short period of time?
In a way, I can't, because I've never designed a piece and then burned it or dismantled it.
Yeah, but you report on it all the time and you've seen it all burn.
You know what I would rather talk about? Okay, so I first went to Burning Man as a reporter for 2 or 3 days, thinking I will come back and I will say, been there, done that, all done. And that's not what happened. I was really fascinated with it, and I've been back a lot of times. I try to go for as long as I can. I can't usually get excused from real life for 2 weeks, but when I can, I will go for a whole 2 weeks. And the reason is this. It's this flat, empty expanse of hard dust. Nothing is there. There are no amenities. There are no, you know, hot dog carts or electricity or anything. There's nothing is there. It's a dry lake bed. And there are 80,000 people who care about this thing enough to go build a city, build a town, build all this art. There are bars and movie theaters and, you know, nail salons or tea houses or whatever they're going to build there. Just go build this other planet and pretend it's an actual place and walk around a city that wasn't there 2 weeks ago and won't be there in 2 weeks. So enough people care about that it makes for an atmosphere of, it's very life affirming. It's just very interesting to see the people want to be that creative and work that hard and be that generous, you know, give away their hundreds of gallons of tea or whatever they're giving away. Like, enough people want to do that it makes for such a cool atmosphere. And that, I didn't come up with this. My husband, Jerry Schneider, came up with this. He thinks of that entire package of being the art project. Which is not to downplay the, like, enormous and wonderful sculptures that are there and other art pieces. Like, I love that stuff. But I think of it more in terms of the whole package.
And yeah, like Burning Man itself is a giant participatory art piece, right? Is that kind of how you
describe it? Yeah, that's the point that Jerry likes to make.
Yeah.
Yeah.
we had some water mud type challenges this last year at Burning Man, and that made a lot of the news too, of kind of the logistics of, again, building a city in a dry lake bed that is covered in dust. When you get a lot of rain, all of a sudden there are challenges that people get stuck and all that. Were you at Burning Man last year?
I was.
And yeah, talk about the mudpocalypse at Burning Man.
You know, there are also the logistics of reporting for a national news organization on an event that you're not at that you really enjoy snarking about.
Do you think that there was a lot of that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The panicked tone of the reporting, I didn't catch it until several days after it came out when I got back, and I did not catch such a panicked tone at the event. Sure, a few people walked out, but I feel like the headline suggested that all 80,000 people desperately tried to claw their way out, and burners go expecting a lot of inconvenience. It was fine.
Yeah. One of the other things that I hear about Burning Man is that the size of it has changed a lot, right? You mentioned it started, you know, a few decades ago. Since then, it's grown to, like you said, 80,000 people. It is a huge city. And I've never been to Burning Man myself. And part of the reason is I feel like I missed the boat a little bit. Like it's too hard now, right? Whether or not this is true, it seemed like, oh, in the past, it might have been an easier thing to do, or it was cheaper, or it was more accessible, or it was not as crazy, not as overwhelming, not as difficult, not as huge, whatever. And you've seen Burning Man over the long time. What do you think about Burning Man's growth and kind of how it itself has changed in terms of scale?
Well, what are the things that you're most eager to avoid?
I mean, I think it's the long lines to get in and out, the amount of stuff that you need to bring with, right, to like build a camp to survive. It all seems like a lot of work to me. And I'm sure it was a lot of work in the past too. But yeah, it just seems kind of intimidating, the amount of stuff to do and bring and manage to make it happen.
Yeah, it's a stupid amount of work and it ruins your life for a little while. And I don't know if that's changed for me over the years.
Do you think Burning Man loses anything by getting as big as it's gotten?
I don't care. People have such expectations about it and such specific expectations. And if you have this freewheeling event with all these people and it changes tone a little bit because there are bigger people or different people or more people or different people or too many not burners or I don't care. I'm just going to go and see what's there. I don't bring a lot of expectations with me. Mm-hmm. I think it's real fun when people from my family members, for example, from the East Coast have told me, you know, I heard it's sold out. It's corporate now. I'm like, well, no, it's not like Pepsi has bought it. That said, I'm probably the only person I can think of who will give you this answer. Having expectations about the event is just part of the event. That's all I got.
What else do you want people to know about Burning Man? Because I think that a lot of people in Northern Nevada just either haven't been and have a perception about it that may or may not be wrong. I think there are people who are super, super dedicated to Burning Man. A lot of the art is created here. Oh, we should talk about the generator too, right? A lot of art is created here in Northern Nevada. So what else is there about Burning Man that's so cool and so exciting? And like, why is it so important?
I guess speaking from my own perspective, I think it's worth the giant hassle of packing all that stuff and getting all that dirty and waiting in those lines, because I can't think of another concentration of people from all over the globe that I would have access to 2 hours away from home, or 10 hours if the traffic is bad. I just have met the most interesting people. The most interesting people have couch surfed on my couch. You just don't know who you're going to run into there or what kind of conversations you're going to have. And I don't have the time and resources to go travel the world on any kind of regular basis. And the rest of the world is willing to come to me, like the most creative and dedicated fans of creativity and art are willing to come to our backyard. Of course, I'm going to go get in on that.
Yeah, that's actually interesting, the kind of the global nature of Burning Man, that it brings people from all around the world. And you mentioned couch surfing, which is both like the generic term of, you know, staying on people's couches. But there's also a website called Couch Surfing, which is where you like have a profile that says, hey, I have a, you know, a spare bedroom or a couch or whatever. And then people can request to stay with you. And in the past, I have frequently used couch surfing to host people who are traveling. And very, very often it would be like European backpackers who are visiting all the national parks and things like that. So I've not traveled internationally that much, but by having people come to you and learning about where they're from and what they're doing, it can be really, really rewarding. So I'm glad you mentioned that as kind of a big part of Burning Man, of, you know, like bringing a large number of people from all around the world right here. It does kind of, it's like reverse international travel.
Right, right. Yeah. Couch surf hosting is a blast.
Yeah. I hope that it still exists. I haven't done it in a long time, but I think that, you know, with the pandemic, it probably limited it a little bit. But for folks who have never done that, I highly recommend it. If you have a spare bedroom or you're willing to host people who are traveling, it is such a great way. I've met so many incredibly cool people, some who I've, you know, stayed friends with and visited and all kinds of things. So yes, couch surfing and meeting people from all around. And I'm glad that Burning Man does kind of bring in, again, it's sometimes even in town, if you don't go to Burning Man, it's still sometimes a hassle because you have like the line at Walmart where everyone's buying their water and bikes or whatever. There is like an abundance of trash that comes into Reno sometimes we don't have the like capacity to deal with all at once. So you end up with like overflowing dumpsters. But like those are pretty small prices to pay, I think, for the both immediate benefit of all of these like cool and interesting people coming through, and the more general benefit of like our arts vibe that lasts through the entire year.
Yeah, I, as starry-eyed as I sound talking about Burning Man, I acknowledge all of those inconveniences for people in town and people on the Paiute Reservation, and you know, anyone who has to contend with 80,000 people squeezing through their town all of a sudden. I get that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Those can grow into actual issues sometimes.
Well, we should talk about the news and review because you are now the editor of the Reno News and Review. And so the News and Review has kind of gone through a couple different iterations. It was a weekly print newspaper during the pandemic. Like advertising revenue doesn't work if all the restaurants and bars and normal advertisers are closed and can't pay for advertising. So it went to just online, but it's come back as a monthly print newspaper. And you're now the editor of the News and Review. Can you talk a little bit about what brought you to that role at the News and Review now? And for folks who maybe don't read the News and Review or are not familiar with it in its current iteration, can you just talk about what the News and Review is and does?
Sure. We're a lot like our previous iteration. The main differences are that we're monthly, so monthly as opposed to weekly. We have a new owner. We used to be owned by the Sacramento and Chico Community Publishing, which also owned the Sacramento and Chico News and Reviews. So we're now owned by Jimmy Bogle, who is stationed in Coachella Valley and who has started a successful print newspaper, which is the Coachella Valley Independent. He grew up here and is a longtime supporter and colleague of Reno journalism and Reno alternative journalism. So he's the one who purchased the Reno News and Review in 2022 and got us back into print. What was the question?
One thing about me is I'm the worst interviewer you've ever met, because I asked like five questions.
Oh, you asked what the differences were.
Yeah, and what brought you to being the editor now?
Well, I have been an editor there before. I was arts editor. I've been on staff a couple of times in the last couple of decades. So it was just a reasonable fit.
What's it like being editor over the whole thing and having more interest or more responsibility for various types of news reporting, right? So you were focused on arts before, but obviously it's not just an arts newspaper. So can you talk about kind of the expanded role of other types of journalism that you're doing there now?
Let me know what you think when the next issue comes out. So yeah, I come from an arts writing and arts editing background. I don't come from an investigative news reporting background. Thankfully, we still have Frank Mullen on our team, who is excellent, excellent, amazing investigative reporter. There's things like that that I shop out, which it's to a large degree, it's a matter of bandwidth, right? Reporters can be versatile and do different kinds of work, but the number of details that you're paying attention to get the paper out every month because fills your brain about 25 hours a day. Yeah. In the handful of years where I was working just with Double Scoop and not the Reno News and Review, there was one thing I did not miss at all. It was the minor tyranny of weekly deadlines. I really did not miss that. But I did miss news reporting. And I'm really glad to have news reporting back in my daily life. It's a really fascinating way to connect with and learn about your community. Mm-hmm. So I'm really glad to have that back on my mental plate.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about just alternative journalism and its value for a community like Reno? I mean, we have, I think, a pretty strong local journalistic community. Can you just talk a little bit about the importance of that?
Yeah. The media landscape has changed quite a bit. Like Alt News Weeklies were real big in, say, the 90s or so, where journalists in a lot of cities decided that a given city's news ecosystem needed another voice in addition to their major daily. And that's what happened here when the News and Review was started in the 90s. Right now, we have so many media outlets, and I think collectively doing a fantastic job of looking at the news in our city from several different angles. There are more news organizations than there used to be. Hmm. And part of the reason for that is because the bottom fell out of the news industry, and small publishers, I think, came into prominence in trying to make up for that. I feel like we're more part of a, I don't want to say a more diverse ecosystem, because I think that implies like a culturally diverse, which I think we all could be doing a little bit better on.
Mm-hmm. Looking to the future for Reno's arts, you've been here a long time. You've seen a lot of how it's changed. What do you hope to see from Reno as, you know, an arts community?
I'm a little stumped. I don't think about the future very much. Mm. I guess I put all of my energy into trying to distill and articulate what's happening at the moment. You got me there. Mm.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. It was great to learn more about. I mean, we've met a handful of times and talked about local arts and stuff, but I always try to include some arts conversations on the show. And I appreciate you, considering you've worked so much in our arts journalism community, coming on to talk about what you do. And congratulations on the stuff with the News and Review, and excited to see what you're doing there, because you're doing really important reporting on some real issues right now.
I'm not used to being on this end of the conversation. Right. It's been delightful. Thank you. No, it's funny. I spend a lot of time telling other people's stories, and I don't spend a lot of time telling my own. Mm-hmm. So thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah. Listeners, thank you so much for tuning in to this week's episode of Renoites. And of course, special thanks to my guest, Chris Wagner, for coming on the show. Again, you can find Double Scoop at doublescoop.art and the Reno News and Review at renonr.com. Like I said, this is the last episode of the current season, so I will be back with new episodes in a few weeks. In the meantime, I may be posting some of the Best of Renoites episodes, so keep an eye on social media. Make sure you're subscribed wherever you get podcasts. And if you have suggestions for guests, feedback, anything like that, shoot me an email, Connor, C-O-N-O-R, at renoites.com, and on Instagram, at renoites.